This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Conversation with someone when they have that revelation,
like,
why are you
making sure that maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're going to start off today with the election. But I don't mean the election, the midterm congressional election. The election we're going to talk about today is taking place on another continent altogether. It's a city council race in Jerusalem. A man named Ramadan Dabash, an Arab community leader, is running for a seat on the city council, and he's been making international headlines for doing so. How come? Well, first of all, in the Arab community of East Jerusalem, there's a long-standing taboo on participating in city politics. The Palestinians there see it as legitimizing Israeli rule. So Ramadan Dabash is taking a huge risk in his own community. And he's doing so at a time when Israeli-Palestinian relationships are at an absolute low. Bernard Avishai is a New Yorker contributor who's a longtime resident of Jerusalem, and he recently met up with the candidate Ramadan Dabash. Bernie, who is Ramadan Dabash and why is he such a big story?
Ramadan is the Mukhtar of Sur Bakr, which is in the southern part of the city. As Mukhtar, he's really head of a council of influential families. If this were a larger village, he'd be like the mayor, but it's not. So he's like head of the neighborhood council. The other thing about Dabash is that he's kind of a hybrid. On the one hand, he's a very traditional guy. He's a traditional Muslim. He has four wives. He brags about 12 children. On the other hand, he's pretty modern. He's an engineer. He's taken his degrees in Israel, and he teaches in Israeli colleges.
Okay.
So I met with Ramadan, drove into Sur Bakr just very recently. Hi, Ramadan. Hi.
Shalom.
Hi, shalom, shalom.
Shalom.
Hi.
Shalom. Hi, shalom.
As you see here.
I interviewed him in English. Before that, I had talked with him in Hebrew, and I must say he's far more articulate in Hebrew than he is in English. But if he were speaking in Hebrew, you would see not only how much more trenchant his ideas are, but also how much of a charisma that he has.
We need cooperation here to be before. Cooperation to make peace before. And that's it. I think it's no problem for us.
Let's step inside and talk about it.
You like to drink some coffee or tea?
Bernie, what exactly is Ramadan campaigning on?
It's all about infrastructure. It's about social services, the kind of things that municipal governments deliver. What kind of services are you talking about?
I talk the services for, first of all, the buildings. They are destroyed, many of buildings here and Arab places here because they don't have a license for it.
And, building permit.
Building permit, yes. This kind of service we need. The second thing, we need the education service and the schools. And we need roads we don't have. Also, we don't have pools. We don't have enough places for the old men and women and for the child. We don't have enough service because that we need to change our mind and to start in the first step here to be inside the municipality.
Bernie, if he wins and he gets on the city council, how effective can he be? And how can he come across as a successful politician to his constituency?
Well, he's already shown that he knows how to work the system. Just as the Mukhtar of his neighborhood, he successfully squeezed millions, really, out of the Jerusalem government for infrastructure, including the community center we were sitting in. The point is that that's hardly enough at this point.
We need 3 or 4 billion shekels here in the East Bank to be a good life here.
That's billion with a B.
Yes, that's the billion with a B.
And what you managed to get for Tsur Bacher before was something like 300 million over how many years?
Three, four years, yes.
So there's a big gap there to close.
Yes, a big gap to close because if it is 50 years until this day, nothing move, yeah. Nothing interesting for us.
You're a secular Jew who lives in a particularly more or less secular neighborhood of West Jerusalem, right. But the city is becoming more and more Hasidic and the rest. What does that imply for as a political challenge to him on the council?
It seems that the Orthodox community is actually quite open to making deals on infrastructure projects because in many ways they mirror his problem. For the most part, these are fairly right-wing people who see the city as being annexed, see the Arab population as being inevitably part of Israel, and so are becoming more and more open to investing on that side of the line. I should say here that part of the reason why he's running here, he's really trying to gain genuine political leverage. He's not just interested in counting on his ability to recruit goodwill on the other side. At the same time, ironically, he's taken as a political advisor a Likud activist, not at all a secular liberal, but an Orthodox Jew who's extremely supportive of the settlement movement. So it was quite an eerie feeling to be sitting there talking to Ramadan on the one hand and listening to his advisor whisper to him and his advisor sitting there with a knitted yarmulke and a clipboard full of data.
Ramadan, you're running with some political advisors.
Yes, this is, he's Mr. Gilad. He's give me service for advisors, my political advisors.
Gilad, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Gilad Israeli.
It's not usual that people wearing knitted yarmulkes are interested in helping to elect Palestinians to the Municipal Council of Jerusalem. Tell me about yourself.
I'm from the right wing of the political map in Israel. And I think in the recent years after the right wing in Israel established himself, people started to realize that you can't say we want Jerusalem united and Jerusalem belongs to Israel and ignore the people who live in Jerusalem. If you want Jerusalem united, Jerusalem is not just lands. Jerusalem is also people living in these lands. And you need to unite the people, the Arab people and the Jewish people around the city, around the Israeli Jerusalem city.
I have to say, Bernie, this is a remarkable thing. Here's an Orthodox right-wing Jewish Israeli trying to get a Palestinian elected to the Jerusalem City Council. I don't quite get his motives.
Well, I'd be lying if I said I did.
But it's kind of incredible. On the one hand, you've got the Orthodox Jewish Israeli whose vision of the future is that all of Jerusalem, to say nothing of the West Bank, be included in what we have long called Greater right. Israel. Whereas Ramadan is clinging to what we've called for now many, many years, the two-state solution, in which there would be a Palestinian state formed out of what we call the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem.
Right.
They're at such innate ideological loggerheads, and to see them sitting there together with you, to hear yes. them together with you, in common political cause is mind-boggling.
Well, naturally, I put the question to both of them.
Can you see this as a model for Palestinian-Israeli relations in the future?
I think the Jewish side is afraid to lose his majority. That is why I don't think the Jews in Israel will want to make the Palestinians an equal citizens. However, there are some raising approaches that the Palestinians will have local authorities, vast local authorities to run their own lives with an Israeli authority like in East Jerusalem today.
So Gilad has a vision of the future where the Arabs are slowly brought in through municipal governments and are given a great deal of autonomy within Greater Israel. Is that your view as well?
I don't want to be in the future in a big jail, like a Gaza Strip or like the Palestinian Authority. The problem here is the people, first of all, to be equal like the Jewish people. And also to be in the United Jerusalem and the Palestinian to be part of this United. So this is my idea. I think it's the people also need this idea.
So the two of you may not necessarily have the same long-term vision, but you're willing to see the importance of the short-term cooperation.
I want to be freedom, first of all, to be freedom, to be person, to be, I have, like the another side, like the, I am a human, like the Jewish people.
But Bernie, I must ask you, as somebody who's been an Israeli for a long time, you began life in Canada, and you lived part of the year in America, but you're an Israeli, and you wrote The Tragedy of Zionism, I don't know how many years ago. Have you yourself given up on the notion of what has been long called the two-state solution?
Oh, no, I haven't. I mean, you can't give up on the two-state solution because you have two separate, distinct national peoples. You have two languages, two different majority religions, two very different cultures. And at some level, you have to imagine drawing a political boundary around these cultural facts. But I think what Ramadan is implying, what I certainly do believe today, is that to make the two-state solution real, both sides are going to have to start coming to terms with confederal ideas. They're going to have to figure out ways that the existing integration will find political expression.
Bernie, where are you seeing signs of confederation in that sense?
Look, Jerusalem Arabs have ID cards. They work in the Israeli part of Jerusalem, the Israeli Jewish part of Jerusalem. Something like 50% of wage earners from East Jerusalem work in the West. And they've started to identify with the institutions of Israel, even if they're not identifying with the self-determination of the Jewish people.
Ramadan, many people in Sur Bacher work in Israel, yes?
All the people working in the Israeli sites.
What kind of jobs are they doing?
They are many of jobs. They are working teachers, they are working in the engineering and driver, and everything they are working, that cleaning, everything they are working inside. We don't have jobs here. We don't have nothing to do in the in this area. All the jobs inside the Israel site.
Construction?
Also construction, and many of people working in construction.
Tourism?
Tourism also, they have a company of bus service for tourism. A lot of people here in the Palestinian side, they are working inside or in the south and the north Israel.
But it also should be clear that even though we're talking about construction, tourism jobs, etc., it's not all menial labor. The joke in West Jerusalem is that if the Arabs struck, the medical system in West Jerusalem would fall apart. That's how many doctors, anesthesiologists, nurses, and pharmacists there are coming from East Jerusalem to work in the West.
Bernie, recently the Trump administration moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. And how has that changed the status quo? How has that changed the picture?
Well, I think it's had the perverse effect of mobilizing Jerusalem Arabs, recognizing that they have to start acting and not simply wait for the great powers or for PA Israeli negotiations to make decisions for them over their heads. I actually talked to Eliezer Yari, a journalist, my friend, who introduced me to Ramadan.
So Eliezer, we're on your porch. Tell us what we're seeing from your porch here.
If you look to the south, you see Kibbutz Ramat Rachel.
Who lives in the very neighborhood that the embassy is.
The new embassy is right down the street from here. You find it ironic that it's there of all places. You want to say why?
I wouldn't call it ironic. I think it's futuristic. In a way, from my point of view, the story of Arnona, my neighborhood, and Surbacher is actually a microcosm of the entire conflict, and also a prospect of partnership and good neighbors, good relationship between the neighbors. It's funny, when they moved the embassy, actually they moved it to the neighborhood, they're very concerned about security. So they covered the fence, which was open, with some kind of a black plastic that now we cannot look at the new American embassy. But if you stand in Surbacher, it's right in front of you. So the view of the new embassy is blocked from us, but it's open to the other side. And the ambassador is not here anyways, because he lives on the ocean in Tel Aviv. I hope that when he comes and lives here, he will wake up in the morning together with me to the sound of the prayers and realize the new embassy is right at the heart of the conflict. Their job is also to help to find a just solution for all the partners who actually are neighbors.
Given all the obstacles, what do you think is Ramadan's definition of victory?
I don't want to sound cynical. But first, the first thing that he will physically survive it.
So his car could get blown up by Hamas because of his secular politics, by Fatah because of his collaborationist reputation, by another family in Surbacher because of his presumption.
And by Israelis because he's an Arab.
So it's when you speak of courage and surviving this election season, you literally mean the courage to survive.
Almost, yes.
Are you afraid for your life?
Look, I am, yes, I afraid for my life, but I don't afraid because I am now 50 years my age. So I don't think I will be more 50 years. So because that, I have to do something for my children, all the children from the Arab side, to change the situation. We need roads, we need schools, we need everything. We don't have nothing. So I start before 4 years to make just for service. So because that, I'm succeed.
Bernie, what are the chances that Ramadan wins his seat? And could his party hold real sway on the city council?
If you're asking, you know, how many seats is he going to win, I really can't say, because in many ways, this is a test also for the Palestine Authority's moral prestige in East Jerusalem. And it's quite possible that there will be a very small turnout. But if there will be a big one, and if you look at the polls, only 14% of Arabs in East Jerusalem oppose running. 58% approve, according to the poll. So there's obviously a shift on the street. A lot of Palestinians are beginning to see that this is their fate, and they had better make the best of it.
And they're making that decision out of a sense of resignation?
Well, resignation, but it's merged with a sense that what do you lose? If in the end there's going to be a Palestine capital in East Jerusalem, having seats on the city council will not preempt that. It does, in a way, imply resignation, but it doesn't really give away the game, and in some ways prepares the ground for the only realistic kind of two-state solution which you will eventually have.
Bernie Avishai, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
That was Bernard Avishai, a contributor to The New Yorker who spoke with Ramadan Dabash, who's running for city council in Jerusalem. The Jerusalem elections are on October 30th. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us. Recently, The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold sat down for a conversation with Franklin Graham, who, like his father Billy Graham before him, is one of the most influential evangelical leaders both within the Christian world and in American politics. Billy Graham was hardly a left-wing figure, but he spoke at times against racial segregation, he preached alongside Martin Luther King, and he offered religious counsel to presidents from Eisenhower to Johnson to Nixon to Ronald Reagan. Franklin Graham was an early supporter of Donald Trump, and he has remained one as scandal after scandal has hit the campaign and the presidency. Graham has remained stalwart in Trump's corner even while opposing policies like the separation of immigrant families. Eliza Griswold spoke with Franklin Graham as he traveled throughout the Northwest on a preaching tour
that he called Decision America.
I've read people talking about your father's message and your message, and your dad saying something along the lines of it, talking about Nixon and talking about moral and ethical mistakes in a general way, but crossing a line. I think he did say toward the end of his life that he felt that maybe he'd crossed a line with his closeness to politics. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you felt about that and what you think he would say about your closeness to politics. Do you feel that you've gotten very close or not
no,
so much?
No, I'm not that close. You meet politicians from time to time. You go to Washington from time to time. For me, I stay out of Washington as much as I can. I don't go up to lobby congressmen or senators. I've been at the White House for a few functions, but I try to keep my distance. But I'm going to speak out on issues that I think are moral issues that we should be speaking out, should be addressing.
Are there any moral issues with President Trump that you disagree on?
Oh, I mean, there is. I'm looking since he's been president. I don't know if you're talking about going back 30, 40 years of his life, 50 years?
I'm not sure we're going back 30, 40, and some of them are ongoing.
Well, I don't know. As far as what he's been inside the White House, I don't agree with everything he says. Don't agree with everything he tweets. But he has been very strong on religious freedom issues, which I appreciate.
I was reading that at some point you said you didn't think, you know, people say that he's been mean, and you didn't see anything that he'd said that had been mean. And that surprised me just because, like, the sound bites that I've seen in terms of making fun of people, it's just not morally kind of your jam.
I don't know if it's meanness or if it's just who he is. I mean, he's a New Yorker, and I don't know, you've known enough about New York. I went to school in New York, high school in New York, and New Yorkers have a little bit of an edge, and that's just the way they are. And I don't think he always means it that way. It's just he says things, and they're very sometimes very blunt. But there's a lot of meanness in this world, and you don't have to go too far. Many people in the media business are very mean. There are other politicians who are very mean. You know, he's the president, whether you voted for him or not. He's our president, and if he succeeds, you're going to benefit. Your 5-year-old son's going to benefit. My 12 grandchildren are going to benefit. If he doesn't succeed, then we all lose.
So one of the times, it just comes to me now that I actually, when I was watching TV during the inauguration, I saw you stand up and give a prayer. And then I heard the speech that Trump gave, which was pretty apocalyptic, about American carnage. Yeah. And I wondered at that time what you thought of that speech. Did that vision of America ring true to you?
Well, I don't think I looked at it like that. I don't, there's lots of speeches that are there for the moment. I think you have to look at what the man does with his job and the work that he does. The fact that he went to North Korea is huge. The fact that he's willing to talk to our enemies, the Iranians. And I think it doesn't mean that we give in to them. It doesn't mean that we give them what they want, but at least we talk. And I think once a conversation starts, it's easy to work our way through our differences. And I think we need to be talking to Russia. I appreciate the fact that he talked to President Putin. And there's a lot of disagreement. They felt that he should have gotten in more aggressive with President Putin, but I don't think that's the way you get things done. I think you talk and you try to work out something that will benefit the people of Europe, people especially the Ukraine, and we need to be praying. As a minister, I want to pray for the President Putin and President Trump, because if the two of them can get along, we can save billions of dollars and not build in arms. And right now, it's almost like the media and those in the Democratic Party want us to have a conflict with Russia.
So in trying to understand Putin a little bit, I've read just a little bit about your on his anti-gay stance, being supportive of that. And also other people, like Mike Pence, for instance, seeing him as a strong leader, that there's something to value in Putin in strong leadership. And I don't know if there's an example for how Putin leads for the West that you think is valuable. Like, is there or not really?
Well, first of all, President Putin is the president of Russia. And he has about, I don't know what his approval rate, but I think it's in the 90s.
It's way high, yeah.
Everyone in the country loves him. He's going to do what's best, what he thinks for Russia and for Russian interest. And we talk a lot about their interference in our elections. I have no clue, okay? I don't know. But I do know that the United States has interfered in many countries' elections. We've interfered in Iran with the Shah. We interfered in Vietnam and put our own people in. We did this in Korea. So I get that. I understand that. We want someone in a country who's going to be friendly to us, that we can work with. And we have tried to manipulate the politics of many nations. And so all of a sudden we get sanctimonious and we get, oh, how terrible, some other countries tried to influence our elections. Well, the Clintons had a huge war chest of money that came from people into their foundation. So, you know, it's easy to point the finger. And I can just tell you that there is enough wrong to go around for both sides.
In the New York Times, there was an op-ed a couple of weeks ago about how the Russians, this Marina Butina and other Russian operatives, had possibly tried to use the evangelical community, like the National Prayer Breakfast, for instance, to try to establish ties over issues like the persecution of Christians, very real issues, where they didn't really, their interest was more in establishing influence than it was in the issue itself. And I wondered if you had any sense of that from Russians that you thought you'd met people that you thought maybe this interest is not. The question is whether the idea of working together is worth it or whether you have ever felt that there might be a manipulation going on.
The prayer breakfast.
Yeah.
And I can't speak for them because I'm not a part of the prayer breakfast. But I go to the prayer breakfast from time to time. And I know that the prayer breakfast tries to bring political leaders from all over the world to expose them to what we're doing in our country as far as it relates to prayer. So I appreciate that. The Russians may have used this, of course, this gives us a chance maybe to rub elbows with somebody we wouldn't rub elbows with. I can tell you right now, everybody in that room has the same agenda. They're wanting to be able to rub elbows with somebody that they normally couldn't rub elbows with. So, I mean, everybody in that room.
Human nature. Political nature.
You know, it is what it is.
Okay. With what we're seeing nationally, this pushback against immigrants, against refugees, and when Jeff Sessions invoked Romans to justify the separation of families on the border, I spoke to many evangelical leaders who were pretty disgusted by that.
Yeah.
And I wondered how you felt about that.
I did not support that at all. I thought that was a mistake, and I spoke out against it. It's just got to be a better system. I don't think you take, and first of all, these government-run facilities that take care of these kids have pedophiles working in there. And we should never be taking children away from parents, period. Hold them together as a family. But to take their children away where they can be exposed to pedophiles, and I believe pedophiles need to be dealt with very harshly. I believe not only incarcerating, but they molest a child. I think they would be probably a candidate for the death penalty. You do not, under any circumstances, as an adult, force yourself on a child. I mean, that gets me mad.
Do you think that this family separation is an issue immigration in general is something that the evangelical community in its diversity could come together around. I mean, here is an issue that is a moral outrage.
Well, I think they're trying to address it. But I think the president has come around to what we're saying. But he also, the president sees the political football that his opponents, they want to use the children to try to make him look bad. And they want to use that. They're not real eager to try to address this whole border issue. It's a point for them. And this is the sad thing, Eliza, is the politics of all this. And it's to take human lives and children and make a football out of them. Listen, I'm all for children and families coming in legally. I do believe that if you're caught at the border, you ought to be turned around and sent back come legally. For people that have been waiting 8, 9, 10, 20 years to try to get their legal status and have someone just walk across the border and get in, no. We need to be a country of law.
So recently, one evangelical leader I was talking to was Ed Stetzer.
Yeah, Ed Stetzer.
So he was saying, do we gain a political advantage through, you know, Supreme Court nominations and protection of religious freedom and other, you know, the recognition of the persecuted church? Do we gain the political advantage but lose our morality by working with this administration?
No. That's, you know, there's some people sit around and they think too much. President Clinton did a lot of good for this country, but he brought the country also to a low that we have never had before. A lot of the moral issues that Donald Trump has had to deal with go back a number of years. To my knowledge, none of this has happened in the White House. There is a difference. I think we do change. I know I'm not the same person I was 20 years ago. And I hope we all learn from mistakes and we get better for that. So I can't speak. All I know is that as human beings, we're all flawed, including Franklin Graham.
Franklin Graham is the president and CEO of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, and he spoke with Eliza Griswold, a staff writer at The New Yorker. Still ahead, a film festival unlike anything you'll ever see in a theater.
I wish we could get some money to pay the mortgage on Mommy's farm.
Yes, then we wouldn't have to be so nice, that haughty princess. And maybe Mommy could have some fun instead of sitting around all day on that farm being poor. The only problem is, where do we get the money?
You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick. Welcome back. Next week on the show, we'll meet a mother who's been deported away from her family to Honduras, and she's been trying to raise her three kids over video call.
Beso, mami. Beso, mami. and she always wants us to give her kisses through the phone.
Nada. I love you.
I love you too, Mom.
Beso, mami.
That's next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Curtis Sittenfeld is an author you might know from novels like Prep, American Wife, and Eligible, a retelling of Pride and Prejudice. Her most recent is a little less romantic than Pride and Prejudice, though. It's a collection of short stories, mostly set in the Midwest, about people raising kids and facing middle age. And in keeping with that spirit, when we asked her to tell us about one of her very favorite places, she took us to a grocery store in St. Louis.
For Gala apples, which are right here. Ugh, that was not a good one. That looks like someone like dug their fingernail into that one and then backed away. So we're in a Schnucks grocery store. Schnucks is a local chain in St. Louis, and this one is in the suburb of Richmond Heights, and it's my go-to Schnucks. We moved to St. Louis in 2007 for my husband's job. We came and we looked at houses, and then at one point I came into this very store and like saw the produce section, and I thought like everything's gonna be okay. I can live in St. Louis. Like, I think that probably seeing a grocery store and seeing like this is nice, it's easy to find a parking place, made me be able to envision my daily life in St. Louis and what it would be. And in fact, since then, I have spent like 35% of my waking hours in Schnucks. So it was an accurate like glimpse of the future. There's this construction going on. So normally it's very soothing to come into Schnucks. It's a little crazy in the background here. All right, let me get some bananas. I have a friend who teases me that I'm like part monkey or something. Like I eat a banana, an apple, and an orange probably every day. Four of my books have come out in St. Louis. That's crazy. I got married in St. Louis. I had kids in St. Louis. So it's like I do feel like I kind of, you know, officially became an adult in St. Louis. In Schnucks, in this aisle. No. I'm gonna get, oh, you know what I need? I need Danimals, actually. A Danimal is basically like a yogurt smoothie. Oh my God, I didn't know they even had cotton candy flavor. I'm looking for strawberry Danimals. Those are rock and raspberry, yeah. And those are, see, I kind of don't want to buy a 12-pack, I want to buy a 6-pack. Maybe the reason I like the grocery store is I can like privately indulge my finickiness as a human being, and like I don't exactly have a witness. Okay, wait, let me see. One of my kids is very fond of the fried chicken, the prepared fried chicken. We once ate Schnucks fried chicken in the Schnucks parking lot in my car, and I feel like it was like a high moment, a high as mother daughter. I have two kids. One of them has food allergies. If you have a child, or I think any family member who has food allergies, the protocol is every time you buy something, you read all the ingredients on the label every time. So I do think like the grocery store is really, it's tied up in sort of daily life in very mundane, practical ways, but it's also, you know, tied up in like my ideas about like safety and protecting my family. And, but I mean, in my fourth novel, which is called Sisterland, it's about a woman who has two young kids, and she lives in St. Louis. She's psychic. So, like, if I'm making fun of the book, I'll say that it's a novel about buckling your children into car seats, but it's about a few other things. But there are literally probably 8 scenes that take place in Schnucks. Literally, the protagonist meets her husband inside this very Schnuck. So I must believe in, like, the romance of the grocery store at some level. So one time I was at Schnucks paying for my food, and I looked over and I saw this man who I swear to God was exactly as I had envisioned the husband. And in the book, his name is Jeremy. And I thought to myself, like, oh my God, like, I conjured him up, or, you know, or he's existed all this time. And I was just channeling his existence. But it was this weird, like, he had this kind of little glasses that I pictured, and he was wearing the kind of, like, parka that I pictured. He was a handsome man. A handsome schnook schnopper, no shopper.
Curtis Sittenfeld at a Schnucks in St. Louis, Missouri. But she doesn't shop there anymore because she's moved to Minneapolis, where there's no Schnucks at all. Curtis Sittenfeld's most recent book is a collection called You Think It, I'll Say It. Now, summer is officially, unofficially over this week, which is awful. Whatever the weather may be doing, the vacations are taken and the kids are now back at school. And so we're going to bring you an end of summer kind of story from no less a writer than the great Calvin Trillin. Trillin has been writing for The New Yorker for more than 50 years. He's done crime reporting, memoir, loads and loads of humor, everything. And for nearly that long, Trillin and his family have been getting together in the summer, and he would show off a very different side of his work as a screenwriter and director of films that you might describe as, at best, niche.
My name is Calvin Trillin, and our movies began many years ago. My girls, who are now in their 40s, were 3 and 6, and we had a Super 8 silent camera. And I don't know why we decided to make a movie with a plot.
The Golden Egg. Once upon a time, in a beautiful land, there was a princess. She had a stableman named Zalman. He was very loyal, hardworking stableman, although quite stupid.
Our first movie was about a golden egg stolen from a haughty princess by a robber with a fox-like grin. And my wife, Alice, was the camera person, or the cinematographer, I guess. And I guess I wrote the movies. I added a narration on a tape recorder, which sometimes was in sync with the action on the screen, and most often was not in sync with the action on the screen. We've never been complimented on our production values.
One day, the loyal stableman came in a terrible excitement. He had something to give her, a golden egg. Even Princess Rosalie had never seen it.
We started going in 1972 to Nova Scotia. I liked arriving on July 1st, which is Canada Day, because I liked the bands playing for us as we went down the South Shore. I perfected sort of a Prince Philip wave. It's in the wrist. We gradually got a sound camera and kept making movies, and then we occasionally came back to the Golden Egg. It was sort of like one of those franchises in Hollywood where they keep going when they need some money.
Hanton's Productions, in conjunction with the Kishka King Trust, presents The Return of the Golden Egg.
My girls were typecast as two lovely little girls at the beginnings, the first movies. And The Haughty Princess was played by Josie Joel, our friend's daughter. She was pretty haughty. I mean, she did haughty very well.
Come immediately.
Come on.
Two for three and hurry.
Oh, it's so nice of you to have us for tea.
Yes, isn't it? And do be tidy. Oh.
The robber with a fox-like grin was played by her little brother, Danny.
Where do we get the money? Why not try stealing? Hey, aren't you the robber with the fox-like grin?
The dumb stableman role was the robber with a fox-like grin's father, who had an excellent chicken imitation, because it turned out that he was the one laying the golden egg. The grown-ups had only bit parts and usually sort of embarrassing or humiliating parts. In the old days when we had film, we would have people to our barn the next summer to see the last summer's movie. Alice and the girls would make cookies and I got beer and had a sheet and we had a projector. We called it the South Shore Film Festival. A Trillin retrospective. Nobody else's movies would be shown in our barn. Then my girls sort of aged out. My older daughter was 15 when we quit. I mean, she didn't complain about it, but I think we all felt that it was about time to stop. Before my younger daughter, Sarah, she got married just about a year before Abigail. We made like a short documentary on Sarah's career as a movie star. And we showed it in the night before the wedding. And just as an indication that parents will never run out of ways to embarrass their children.
I just can't say, I just can't say. It's so difficult to know. Though I know that stealing's naughty.
When we thought with our grandchildren, we would just start over again. My wife died and just before the first grandchild arrived, but we did exactly that. And we waited, and I don't know how old they were, but only a few years before we started again.
Passport, please. What is the purpose of your visit?
We're looking for a robber with a fox-like grin. He stole the egg from our princess.
My younger daughter, Sarah, had an emergency appendectomy, and the kids, particularly her kids, were sort of worried about it. I guess we were all a little tense about it. So we did it partly just to take their minds off of it and to take our minds off of it. From there on out, we had regular movies, I think. Isabel, my older granddaughter, played the proprietor of a snooty inn. She does a good snooty. And my older grandson, Toby, pretty much had a lock on the robber with a fox-like grin role. I think he had watched Danny play it many times in that movie. And my younger granddaughter often played the marshal, who got to the dock just in time to see the robber with a fox-like grin flee in a boat, and always said,
"Rat for it again."
I love the way she said, particularly before she got her R's under control.
Again.
It's the same escape route, but it's always in the boat from the dock.
Rat foiled again!
My grandchildren, fortunately, are very close, even though they live far away from each other. They see each other in Nova Scotia and at Christmas and various times. And yeah, it helps that, I think. It's great to have a kind of multi-generational summer place, and the satisfaction of gathering blueberries with your grandchildren in the same place you gathered them with your children.
No one ever knows what he has designed. Marshall and the boss are always way behind. You can always tell the chase is over when you hear the marshal saying that she's foiled again. Will these people ever catch him as they chase him all about? The answer may compel you. Sorry, we can't tell you. You must watch the sequel to find out.
The summer of 2016, the kids were getting a little old. We were about done with the movies we made. So I think we all had the idea that maybe this was the last summer that we would do it, and that's why we did another Golden Egg.
And finally, this evening, a mystery story from Nova Scotia about the legendary Golden Egg, whose whereabouts have captivated the world for years. Here reporting from
Isabel, who had often been the innkeeper, this time was a TV reporter.
Where is the golden egg that was stolen from a haughty princess by a robber with a fox-like grin many years ago?
Toby played the robber with a fox-like grin.
Did you follow that dream?
Yes. When I was 12, I found out I could do a fox-like grin.
And you stole the golden egg?
Yes, but I lost it in a poker game. So now I can't do the grin, so I've lost my identity.
You must believe in yourself. I think you can do it. Just try.
Another aspect that seemed sort of to put a punctuation mark on this, the original robber with a fox-like grin, Danny Joel, now Daniel S.S. Joel QC, a barrister in London, was coming to North America with his three kids and his wife, and so we put him back in the movie. He played Lord Chumley of Snarf.
Lord Chumley, as you know, there have always been rumors that you were the original robber with the fox-like grin who stole the golden egg from Princess Rosalie.
Rubbish.
Rubbish. Absolute rubbish.
At the end of this movie, and this is a spoiler alert, the end of this movie, the egg actually gets scrambled and eaten. They insisted on that. The cast insisted that it get eaten, even though I always assumed it was solid gold and not edible.
Delicious. Maybe next time I'll try sunny side up.
Rat foiled again.
Just to know where that egg had been stashed by the rich guy who wouldn't say. Was it on the beach?
One of my grandchildren, I think it was Toby, my older grandson, said the other day, what are we going to do next summer without a movie? And the kids are used to it, and they look forward to Nova Scotia. My granddaughter, Rebecca, who is interested in writing, has already decided that she'll be the screenwriter when they make them for their kids. And she's a little worried about the plot. She's a little concerned about how to bring the egg back if it's already been eaten. And but I told her she could actually start with some other franchise. She doesn't necessarily need the golden egg, and she said she might just do that.
Ate the egg, that's so groovy, cause this is our final movie. And we no longer need that egg of gold. And we no longer need that egg of gold. Of gold.
Members of the Trillin family and friends singing a number that I believe is called Egg of Gold. You can find everything Calvin Trillin has written for The New Yorker for 50-plus years, including his essay, Final Cut, about their home movies at newyorker.com. And that's it for us today. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado.
This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botin, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Calla Leah, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Zach Dyer, Eric Malinsky, Mishi Harmon, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.